Welcome back to the Community Partner Show, where we try to highlight heroes in our community, people who do really cool things to make our community a better place to live in. And today, we're here with Sherry Dougal. And I'm hoping I'm actually pronouncing her name absolutely correctly. She'll correct me.
You pronounce it perfectly, Michael. Thank you so much.
Okay. And Sherry, you're a naturopathic doctor by profession. You have dance and movement as a strong part of your well-being and what you present to our community. And you are now about to be a published author. And what's the name of your book?
Well, my first book is called Beneath the Surface. Mm-hmm. And my second book is called Shringar, The Different Shades of an Indian Bride.
Wow.
I did a mini book tour in India for my second book. Mm-hmm. And my second book launch will be set for October 25th at Kino's Cafe.
Oh, great. Great.
Yes.
So we look forward to your book. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the from what I understand, the book is about the symbolisms and things behind being an Indian bride. Is that right?
Yes. So basically, the whole book is a transformation that occurs as she becomes transformed into a goddess. So being a bride is like a goddess, and so I cover it step by step from head to toe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay. You were once the bride, right? Or not?
I have never been married.
Okay.
You can't help but notice an Indian bride.
That is very
Indian
true.
Indian woman all decked up. So yeah. There's 16 traditional ornamentations mm-hmm. that an Indian woman wears, which is what my whole book is about. Sola means 16. Shringar means ornamentations.
Oh.
And 16 is considered the embodiment of perfection. Of course, as you say, sweet 16.
Mm-hmm.
But this number also corresponds to the 16 phases of the moon. So the moon is a prominent image in my book. And so all of these adornments are also a means to protect from the highs and lows of a woman's cycle. Which is very fascinating.
Okay, I do have a native background, and one of the things mm-hmm. that they talk about when the cycle comes around, they call it their moon.
Yes.
So that's very interesting.
Everything in life has cycles. A native culture is also very nature-based.
Yes.
And yes. I love it. So that's one of the reasons why I always gravitate towards native culture too, because it's so grounded. It's mm-hmm. so earth-based. That's how I like to describe it as.
Right.
And the Indian philosophy is also very similar. The five elements. We have a god associated with the wind. The wind god is called Vayu. The sun god, of course, the sun is very important in native culture. In many cultures,
yes,
it's called Surya Devta. So different names for all of those different elements. And I incorporate some of that Indian mythology and my knowledge of Indian philosophy into my poetry.
Yeah. So, were you born in India or were you born here?
I was actually born in Vancouver.
Okay.
But I have a very strong tie to my own culture, whether it's through Indian classical dance or Bharatanatyam or through Bollywood cinema. I just love the whole culture because I feel that India is one of the spiritual centers of the world. And I think that's why I lean towards it, because I'm very spiritual-minded myself.
Yeah.
I think all of us have that spirituality inside of us.
Yeah. I love the Indian culture, one, for its color and beauty, but two, because I know a lot of people, they talk about yoga, but when they talk about yoga, they mean it as like an exercise. But when I talk about yoga, it is the meditation and the healing that that comes with that. So,
and also yoga is also being one with your surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole creative process, whether it's writing or acting or dance, any form of expression, its true form involves becoming one with everything. Like when I'm writing a poem or when I'm dancing, I just forget about everything and I become one.
Right.
I'm sure runners also can relate to that. When you're running and in the midst of it, you become one with everything around you. So, yeah, and that's the essence of what I try to portray in my book. We are all one, and one of the essences is the feminine. And the feminine and masculine are like the yin and yang. You can't have one without the other. So,
right.
Yeah.
So, okay, so there's 16 symbolisms. I would love to be able to actually
speak in the right
language, but yeah, let's start off by let's go through them. And
yeah,
so which direction do we start from? We start from the head
working
down,
toe.
Head to toe. Okay,
there you go. Actually, before we start with the ornamentations, if it's okay, I'd love to read the first poem in my anthology.
Oh, that would be great to start off with the poem.
Good,
yeah, that would
yes,
be great.
I think that'll be a great introduction to those 16 elements.
Okay.
Thank you. So, my first poem is called Omnipresent. It says, Omnipresent. Her shapely form covers the expanse of the earth, and as she takes us through the landscapes of our mind into the depths of creation, you can trace maps in her bloodstream. Her curved pathways become the meeting point of land and water, and as waves crash on distant shores, her silence echoes inside you. Felt in the breath of a full moon, her presence glows, filling you with white light. She seeps through darkness. Her each exhale guiding you step by step. So that is the very first poem.
Wow. That is a beautiful poem.
Thank you. And as I mentioned, the moon is a very prominent image in my book. So that's why I wanted to incorporate the moon into my first poem in my anthology.
Wow. So your poem, what inspired it?
I think nature, mother, the whole concept of Mother Earth, and you being of native origin, I'm sure you can understand this and relate to this. Just the whole idea of Gaia or Mother Earth and just becoming one, and how the feminine is one with the earth. And yeah, that's a key image that took place in my mind. And yeah. The sun is considered the masculine, and the moon is considered the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other thing in many cultures. So yeah, that's what inspired me.
Wow. Cool. So what is the first ornamentation called?
Okay, so we're going to start with the hair.
Okay.
So what you do, of course, there's traditional garlands or flowers that are put into your hair, and traditionally everything is tied in threes, so the braids occur in threes, which reminds me actually of Christianity, the Trinity.
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yes, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So the Trinity, the threes, in Indian culture includes the gods Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, just like the Trinity. Brahma is the creator. Vishnu is the preserver. And Shiva is a destroyer. And I don't like to say destroyer, really, because I think Shiva has to do more with rebirth, more than anything else. Okay. The three braids can also symbolize Ganga, Jamuna, Saraswati, which are the three main rivers in India. And it can also represent the bride herself, because she is the link between her family and his family. So that's also the Holy Trinity there that happened. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah.
So, the whole, as we go through the 16 the 16 ornamentations, it sounds like we're going to get quite a history philosophical lesson about India also.
Oh yes, it's definitely inspired by Indian mythology, Indian philosophy and spirituality. But the good news is, Michael, I have little notes after each poem.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you're non-South Asian, you can still try to understand it and get the essence of it. Because what I wrote, of course, it's based on Indian culture, but I think it's universal.
Mm-hmm.
I made my poetry universal, and I made it so that everyone can relate to it. That was pretty much the aim of my book. Whether you're male, whether you're female, we all have that feminine inside of us. So my goal was to help everyone tap into that feminine and not be afraid of it.
Right. That's an important point that because there's so many people in a lot of cultures that think that if I'm male and I show any female trait, that I'm less of a man, or
yeah,
vice versa, I'm less of a woman, and that's simply not true. There's a balance, right?
There is definitely a balance, and tapping into your feminine side is being vulnerable. And many people are afraid to be vulnerable. But we have to remember, everything comes in balance. So it is very important to tap into that vulnerability, because that's where all the creativity happens.
Mm-hmm.
That's where all the healing happens. Because when you're vulnerable, you're open to life, you're open to experience, you're open to the universe.
Right.
And so being receptive is pretty much being feminine.
That's a good way to put it. I like that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anytime you're open or receptive to something, to your body, intuition, to the universe, allowing yourself to be guided, you're tapping into your feminine.
Mm-hmm. So, with that is how do we, because if we're starting from head to toe and we started with our hair, we're also
mm-hmm.
starting with our mind, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
How do we keep our mind open and receptive?
It's not easy. It is definitely not easy. The big part of it is being aware. Awareness is key. I always like to do a self-check throughout the day. How am I feeling? How am I feeling? Why am I feeling this way? And that kind of helps me tap into myself, and it also helps me understand better. And I think that's how I do it.
Mm.
Because I believe that every day there are signs that occur. Dreams. Dreams are also very symbolic. So I think just being aware.
Yeah.
And I think that is the key thing to tap into your feminine.
Yeah.
And many people are afraid to tap into themselves because a lot of scary stuff comes up. But I think that is part of the healing process. Oh. And I think that's the only way you can grow and develop is if you acknowledge, okay, I'm feeling this way. Why do I feel this way? Okay, what can I do to change it?
Right. I agree mm-hmm. with you that is very true. And a lot of us, as you said, are afraid that they're opening Pandora's box as opposed to to introduce a different culture.
I love that Pandora's box.
Yeah.
That's exactly the image. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Pandora's box, you use that term, all cultures are interconnected.
Yes.
The fact that you use that term just proves that, mm-hmm. which is awesome.
Yeah.
And artists are weird that way, Michael. Artists are very weird because we allow ourselves to go through that process.
Amen
especially
to that.
Especially actors. Yes, actors and writers especially.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes I'm writing and tears come into my eyes. I'm just crying as I'm writing because that's just part of the process. That's just part of the letting go.
Yes. It is. It is. Mm-hmm. It is.
But when you're working on a scene and you feel vulnerable, the tears just flow, and that's, again, part of the process and part of the healing and part of awareness and part of understanding each other better and being more empathic towards each other, pretty much.
Yeah. You know, it goes back to what you said about being one. When you're dancing, you become one. It's like you hear the music, but you don't hear the music. You hear the crowd, but you don't hear the crowd.
Yes.
Right? I'm a musician, so it's like when I become one with the whole experience is like, it's like yeah, they're there, but they're not there. It all just kind of blurs in together, and it's kind of it's.
Yes.
It's hard to explain at times, but until somebody experiences it, then you understand what I mean, and hopefully we're explaining it in a way that somebody who isn't an artist will understand also. So,
and you know what? Even if you try to describe it, it's not possible because the experience is just such a spiritual one,
mm-hmm.
and it's such a unique and personal one. So everyone experiences that oneness in different ways. And that's the gift.
Yes.
That is the gift that each one of us has inside of us, is being able to tap into that. Because as mentioned, that's where all the healing occurs. That's where all the shifts occur in your body, even physiologically.
Yes.
Nervous system, blood flow, everything. Everything changes once you get into that state.
Yes.
To letting go, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that is so important at times. Well, when you let go and you open yourself up, that's where acceptance is also, right?
You're absolutely right. So. That is acceptance. And I think that's what's missing today, Michael, is many people don't allow themselves to be creative. Because being creative puts you into that meditative state.
Mm-hmm.
When you become one with everything. And I think that's the problem, is that many people... Yeah, creativity is the missing ingredient to health.
Yeah.
Deepak Chopra's words. And you know, it's not only acting, writing, or dancing. It can be even in the way you raise your kids.
Yes.
It can be in the way it can be in the way you prepare a meal.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so many different ways to get into that meditative state, and just to get into that relaxed state. And I think the key to life, one of the secrets, is to find out what puts you into that particular state.
Because
for you, it's music.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's writing and acting. Everyone has something different.
Yes. And different combinations of that. So.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So with that, let me get to a break.
Perfect.
And you know what? You supplied us with a couple of musical pieces, and let's see. So we're going to actually go to a break with one of those musical pieces.
Oh, perfect! Why don't we do Bindiya Chamkegi?
Is that what you
Bindiya, and it goes Bindiya Chamkegi, Churi Khankegi. Which means the dot on my forehead will glow. Churi Khankegi, which means the bracelets on my wrist will also make their sound.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll go to
which goes along with those particular ornamentations.
Okay. So we'll go to a break with that song, and we'll be right back. And we're back, and you're listening to Community Partners, where we celebrate heroes in our community. And today we're speaking with Sherry Dougal, and she is a published author and as many other things. We heard a poem that she did and everything. So we're going to get back to, we were talking about the 16 ornaments that that help dress an Indian bride. So, yeah.
So, shall we go on to the next one?
Yes, we should.
So, the next element is called sindoor. And sindoor is red-colored. It's a red-colored powder that is put on the parting of the bride's hair. And this is initially done during the actual wedding. So, the groom put some of the sindoor onto the bride.
Okay.
And this is a very important image in even a lot of movies. Ek chutki sindoor ki keemat tum kya jaane? Which means, what do you know the value of a little bit of sindoor, of the powder? What do you know of the value? So, and it's a big moment when she puts a sindoor on her head, because officially then she's his and he is hers. So, it's captured in Indian cinema also.
Wow. I've seen that symbolism in a lot of movies, and I never really totally understood the total significance. Wow.
Now, the reason they do put that in the lining of the hair is for the longevity of the husband, to make sure that he can have a long life, because he's the protector of her and her kids. And, it also represents basically the female energy, which is called Shakti. The female energy that protects all married women against outside evil forces. So all of these ornamentations, a lot of them are also a means to protect the husband.
Oh.
And that's how much value we put on it.
So he's receiving protection so that he may protect.
There you go. It's a mutual bonding that happens.
That that brings to bear the question of in our world today about relationships. I hope you're listening out there, guys. How often do we forget that we are supposed to protect, and we just look for our wives to give us gratitude without us offering our protection first?
And not to take anyone or anything for granted in life, you know?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful bond. And the whole idea of marriage in Indian culture is for both bride and groom to become better individuals. To become better individuals and to help each other on to the spiritual path. And the whole process is a spiritual one, but marriage not only brings two families together, but it also brings everyone involved closer to God. It is actually a sacred, I'm just reading from my book actually, it is a sacred union that happens only once in one's lifetime. That's kind of the meaning behind the wedding and the union that happens.
That's an important thing to note. Now, I do have a question, because there is within the Southeast Asian culture arranged marriages.
Yep.
Now, how does that? Because here in the West, that's appalling. Arranged marriages. We're supposed to marry because of love, but there are times that in Western culture we forget that we're also supposed to bring purpose with that love when we enter that marital union. And so how does that play out with the Southeast Asian ideal of arranged marriage? Is the purpose built straight in?
Yeah, it's just an assumed thing. Once the marriage happens and it's arranged, it is assumed that these two will look after each other and help each other become better people. Mm-hmm. So, but it's also a form of respect towards the parents. Of course, parents are revered, also given a lot of respect. But I think it's also important to realize that you have to make your own decisions also in life. Mm-hmm. And that you need to take an active role, whether it's arranged, whether it's love, in terms of who you want to be with. And not being pressured into anything. For those listening. Because that's the fight that can happen. That's a struggle in Indian culture. Okay, I want to listen to my parents, but that's not what I want. Mm-hmm. I have to listen to my parents. I have to get married to him, but I don't want to. Or I want to become an artist, but I have to become a doctor, lawyer, or engineer. Mm-hmm. What do I do? Do I go against my parents, or do I follow my heart? So I think that by following your heart, I think that is also a very important element in the whole decision-making process that you go through.
So, okay, being the Westerner here, I guess it was assumed that there's no room for that, for you to follow your heart in the Indian culture. So how does that you either follow your parents or you're either disowned or thrown away or something, is what the Western assumption is, but that's not sounding to be true. It sounds like there's something else going on there.
And I think also parents need to be aware that there is these days, women do get married at a later age. Yeah. So I think not pressuring them, allowing them to follow their heart, I think part, it's give and take. So I think parents also need to be aware of that so that there can be more of a collaboration that occurs in the decision-making process. Giving each other breathing room and breathing space. I've always been the rebel in my family. But I think my parents have learned to accept me more, for sure. And I've learned to accept them more. Mm-hmm. And they realize that, okay, she's published her second book. She's accomplished so much. So I think that's part of giving each other breathing room. Let's put it that way. Yeah. To kind of do what you want to do and to support and to encourage each other.
Yeah.
It's important.
And I imagine it's as a parent that's not always the easiest thing you because you've walked a path.
Yeah.
And you've walked so far down that path and you have so much experience that you just want the wisdom to be taken. Don't make my mistakes. But sometimes you have to allow your children to make the same mistakes you did because there's a different lesson for them than you had.
And the only it's not easy, but that's part of life. That's part of the growth process, is learning from your mistakes and your failures.
Yeah.
Nothing is perfect in life. And if we acknowledge that fact, then we can say, okay, I'm proud of you. Keep at it. This didn't work. What can we do next? Let's go to plan B, or let's go to plan C, you know? Mm-hmm. Just never giving up.
Yeah.
Never giving up.
Yeah, this never giving up. Yeah. So, what's
the next ornamentation of the Indian bride or their shringar is the bindi or the dot on the forehead. I'm sure everyone's seen that.
Yes.
In even in everyday, you might see someone wearing a bindi at the mall or anywhere you're walking. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the bindi has to do with the third eye.
Okay.
And it has a lot to do with the intuition. The third eye is actually one of the chakras or energy centers of the body. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you've heard of them, and there's seven of them.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
I don't remember all of them, but I know that there is seven.
It starts with the base chakra, goes on to the sacral, the solar plexus, the heart, the throat, and then you go on to the third eye.
Yeah. So I remember someone trying to they said that my creative energy was closed because my third eye wasn't opening.
Wow.
And they did a series of meditations with me and a series of massages and things like that to open up my third eye. So, yeah.
That is beautiful. Everyone is different. I know the chakras that I'm working on is my heart chakra and solar plexus chakra. Everyone's different in terms of what chakras need to be worked on. And I think that is, as we were talking about, part of the healing and part of the growth and awareness process is being aware of your body and in tune with it and think, okay, what can I do to open that area up and to clear that energy so everything can flow?
Yes.
Because life is all about flow.
Yes.
In Chinese medicine, you have the meridian. It's all about energy flowing through those meridians, which is what inspired my first book.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because we're energy, and energy, if it if it stays still. I know it, in physics, we say that the energy can't be destroyed or created, but
yes.
Energy can actually die out if it isn't allowed to move and flow. And that's
stagnation. Stagnation causes a lot of problems in the body.
Mm-hmm.
For example, stagnation. If there's stagnation in your bladder, for example,
mm-hmm.
it causes urinary tract infection.
Mm-hmm.
If there's stagnation of any sort of energy flow, it manifests in different ways, and one of them is pain and inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And inflammation is when an area becomes red or itchy. Inflammation is the start of all the different disease conditions that we have. So I think the key in life, the other little secret, is to keep that energy flowing, keep that energy going, mm-hmm. through that creative process and through that letting go.
That's an important thing to know. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Shall we go on to the next ornamentation?
Yeah, we should. Especially, we stopped it at our third eye. Let's move on.
Perfect. So now, after the bindi, we mm-hmm. have the kajal, or the eyeliner. The eyes are the windows to the soul. I'm sure you've heard of that expression.
Very many times and in very many cultures.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So the eyeliner in itself was used to protect one from the harsh rays of the sun.
Oh, okay.
That was one of its functions. The other function is to protect from ill wishes or lustful eyes. Warding off malevolent spirits while cleansing the eyes.
Wow.
So it's cleansing. Mm-hmm. It protects you also from the sun, and it also protects you from so-called evil eye.
Okay.
And that's why when a baby is born, they put eyeliner on it, and they take a little bit of the eyeliner and put it behind the ear. As a means to protect the baby, so no one can be jealous of it, or no one can be, you know, put negative energy towards that little soul.
Oh. Now that's something that I didn't realize. Wow.
Absolutely. Many different cultures have different ways to protect from the evil eye. I know Egyptian culture. In Egypt, also has the same thing.
Yeah.
They're very similar, protecting you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember in Italian culture, because being mixed is one of the being mixed culturally, that was one of the things is the horn that did you see Italian? An Italian jewelry, the horn, the gold horn, is to protect against the evil eye. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's the whole essence behind a part of the essence of the kajal or eyeliner that one wears.
Wow.
And, of course, you can captivate your partner just with one glance.
Yes.
Because like you said, your eyes do speak. Eyes can speak louder than any words sometimes.
There was something else as an artist performing on stage, the use of eyeliner to make your eyes stand out so that people would center on you for the attention of what you're doing on stage. So as you put that, yeah.
Oh my goodness, yes, eyes are very expressive, and even in Indian classical dance, the eyes are very heavily, you put a lot of eyeliner around the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
in Indian classical dance, whether it's Bharatanatyam or Kathak or any of those dance forms.
Yes.
In the different parts of India, yeah. Because like I said, the eyes tell stories, and sometimes the eyes can speak louder than words.
That is also very, very true. How expressive our eyes actually are. So, we're going to get to our next break, and
okay.
Which and welcome back to Community Partners, and we're here with Sherry Dougal, and I guess we've gotten through a few of the symbolisms for the Southeast Asian bride. And I do have a question, though. Because I know there's several different regions of India, and each of those regions of India has a... While there's a lot of similarities throughout the India with culture, they may have some variances and also some language differences. So is this specific to a part of or all of India?
Excellent question, Michael. Now, as you know, we have so many different types of languages in India, mm-hmm. depending on the area. There's Hindi, Malayalam, Bengali, all of those different languages, so many different dialects, different climates, different dance forms in each region, from north to south. Mm-hmm. Each region has its own different kind of ritual, or their essence is the same, but they have different ways of doing things. My poetry book is a North Indian perspective.
Okay.
My parents are from Punjab, and Punjab is in the north of India, so my book is through my lens, what mm-hmm. I've seen through the weddings that I've attended in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, mm-hmm. and it's also a North Indian perspective in terms of what I've seen in Bollywood cinema. So that is what I'm offering. That is my offering to my poetry right. anthology. It is a North Indian perspective.
Okay, because I think for the most part, I have done some Indian wedding photographs, and also when I actually appear in front of the camera, my makeup artist is also from Punjab.
Wonderful!
Yeah, and she does wonderful wedding makeup. So, yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And yes, the whole process of becoming a bride takes a while. I'm sure you saw my book trailer, the henna itself, or the mehndi. The henna took about four to five hours to do.
Now,
this whole process involved.
Yeah. Along with that process, Are there meanings or anything to the designs within the henna?
Why don't we say that when we get to the hands or the henna element
okay.
of the shringar?
All right.
We've got to leave some suspense for the audience,
yes.
right, Michael?
Yes, that's right.
So that is to be answered, because, like I said, we do have to leave some suspense for
yeah.
the audience.
Okay. All right.
So, perfect question to be answered. I was thinking we can go on to the next shringar.
Yes.
And that is the headpiece you see dangling on the forehead. That is called the mang tikka. And of course, it also is related to the third eye.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just reading the note in my book after this poem that I wrote. The third eye is visualized as having two petals. Each chakra is associated with a particular image. Its presiding deity, or god, is Ardha Narishwara. And Ardha Narishwara is where God is represented as half man, which is Shiva, the masculine, and half woman, Parvati, which is the feminine. The third eye stands for preservation, where a woman reiterates her status as the preserver of the human race. She is the preserver.
That's a big job.
It's a very big job. We are creators. And that's one of the images that I use, is the whole creative force. The whole idea of a woman being creators. Because we are. Mm-hmm. We definitely are. And I love the whole Ardha Narishwara image of half Shiva and half Parvati. Because like I said, we tend to forget. One can't exist without the other. Both complement each other. They're like the yin and the yang. We can't have night without day. We can't have good without bad. So it's kind of respecting both halves of the universe. And that's what kind of the monk Tikka Shunga reminds us about.
Okay, so that's why it is worn as a headdress.
Yes, and it's also, it's like a little headpiece, and, it's wonderful. I love wearing tikka. Because you can match the colors to the outfit you wear. And there's so many different elaborate styles. Wow. Because jewelry is given a lot of importance in India. And you know why, Michael?
Why?
Jewelry is important to decorate not only the body, but the soul. And that is why we give so much importance to it.
Okay. Yeah, because we're gonna get back to this. I think this is one of the differences from Western culture to Southeast Asian culture or Indian culture. How does the jewelry adorn the soul? How does that work?
It's just a way to, you know, you decorate your space at home.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you decorate your space? To make it beautiful.
Yeah.
To give it a nice energy. So if we're decorating our space, if we keep our space clean and decorated, why can't we keep our bodies clean? And why can't we decorate our bodies?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons why, it's all about the soul in India. Even when we greet someone, we say namaste.
Yes.
Namaste, Michael. So I'm saying my soul greets your soul, pretty much. And that's why even guests are treated with such hospitality. Because they're not just physical beings, they are also other souls, just like us.
Yeah. We are spiritual and energetic beings, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Wow. So that... That explains the significance of the jewelry, because it was one of the things that I noticed doing the photography was all the beautiful jewelry, you know.
in my book trailer. Yep, you definitely, I'm sure you saw all those different elements. And yeah, they don't leave any part of the body bare. A lot of our body, from head to toe, our hands, our feet, even our toe, we have toe rings, which is one of the elements,
mm-hmm.
is all decorated, which is, I think that's beautiful. So,
yeah. Yeah. And I like how you go past in Western culture, the bride is the princess, and you've gone past that to goddess. That's really wonderful. Okay, so what's the, mm-hmm.
The next element is let me take a look here, the nose ring.
Okay.
And the nose ring is a way to reduce the monthly menstrual pain. When women go through their menstrual period.
Yeah.
It's a way to reduce the pain. And it's also, in a lot of movies, we see this image of the groom slowly removes each of those 16 ornamentations. They're sitting on the bed and in the wedding night, he's slowly removing their everything. And in India, the deflowering of a virgin is symbolically referred to as the removal of the nath, or nose ornament. So that's kind of another symbolism behind it. Hmm. She's becoming a woman now. So she's becoming, yeah, a woman. And symbolically, once the nose piece is removed, that's what it kind of symbolizes. The deflowering of the virgin.
Wow.
It's just a beautiful image.
Yeah.
Even in Indian cinema, there's a song, Kabhi Kabhi, where he's removing all her ornamentations.
Right.
It's just, yeah. Just, yeah, it's beautiful.
Wow. It's, the adornments, the ornaments are, or it's just a simply beautiful thing. And there's, the wedding itself isn't just, the celebration, I should say, of the union isn't just a single day like it is. It's over a few days, right? Celebrating.
Oh yeah, Indians. Trust me, Michael. Indians love to party. We love to eat. I know I do, at least.
Oh yeah.
I'm a foodie.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I love to eat, I love to party, and I love to celebrate, and Indians are all about celebration. From the henna ceremony, we have the mehndi ceremony, we have the lady sangeet, we have the reception, the actual wedding. So yeah, it's a whole kind of sequence of events where we all get an excuse to celebrate.
Do we need an excuse? Can't we just... No.
That's true, right?
Yeah, right.
That's a good point. We can celebrate every moment if we want.
Yes,
we can celebrate every day. At the end of the day, we can celebrate the day by asking ourselves, what are we grateful for?
Very true.
Right?
Yeah.
What are we grateful for today? I always do a gratitude list before I sleep. So.
Yeah. I do the same myself. So,
wonderful!
You know, run through as I fall asleep. Run through the things that I'm grateful for.
So, that's lovely.
Yeah,
wonderful. So, shall we go on to the next element?
Yes, we should.
Michael, being an Indian woman is a sensory experience. All the senses come alive, and one of the 16 elements of the bride is the ittar, or perfume.
Mm.
Uh-huh. So stimulates the sense of smell,
mm-hmm.
and makes that come alive. And it's a way to keep the bride fresh as she goes through the process. And during the winters, warm mm-hmm. perfumes, like musk, and I'm reading my book again, just a little note.
Yeah.
During the winters, warm perfumes like musk, amber, and saffron were worn. And during the summers, cooling perfumes like cass, rose, jasmine, and gouda were preferred. So it just depends on what kind of perfume, whether you want it to be cooling or heating, depending on the season.
Wow.
Yeah. That's... Maybe I can read you this poem, the Ittar one?
Yeah, let's go for the poem. Yes.
Maybe I'll read this full one. What do you say?
Well, we have.
How are we doing for time?
We have about 4 minutes left to this episode, but we had discussed that we will probably have part one and part two to the actual interview. So we're going to have to air this in two episodes, which is cool, right? And we really get to promote your book too, right?
You know what? I'm grateful. Thank you so much. I'm just having so much fun chatting with you now.
Yeah.
So why don't we end with this poem?
Okay.
And yeah, so it's called Ittar or Perfume. She becomes a storm cloud visible on the horizon. Her scent lies in between creases, gathering in the folds of her sari. And as fabric slithers down her shoulder, she teases the groom. She teases the groom with a light drizzle. She starts to fall heavy. At first a gentle breeze, she's now the wind gone wild in the trees. Carrying him through pauses in time, he becomes a leaf that lingers in the air. And sweeping past the landscapes of their bodies, she takes him through the seasons, soaking him in her fragrance. Bare skin lies exposed, and as essences seep through fertile earth, seeds burst open, bringing memories to the surface. She paints a picture of an eternal spring, and while immersing him in a rainbow of colors, her light becomes reflected in prisms, a potpourri of moods that cling to her as though she is the flower itself, appearing in different forms. She comes and goes, and even Vayu, the wind god, is left to her mercy.
Well, this will end part one of the interview, and tune in next week so that you can hear part two, because Sherry has lots more elements to go through, and we'll see you next week.
And once again, thank you for having me on Community Partners, and I really enjoyed this, and I'm looking forward to part two. Stay tuned, everyone.
Okay.